and over time morphed into an outsized horror of fear and helplessness, of mass death. Though he didn't think his horror could be outsized, really. How could it ever be big enough? And yet it must be somehow disproportionate, because most people seemed untroubled by the origins of the meat they ate. By the scrawny dogs everywhere, abandoned in hard times, likely to starve or be picked up by the dog catcher and killed. Why couldn't he make peace? The world was not going to change. He would be happier if he could simply forget. He skipped dinner and lay on his bed in the boarding house as evening purpled the window. He loved Caleb, and Caleb killed animals. But hunting pained Jamie less than slaughter. Hunting was an intersection of two lives, not a corralling, an extermination. But Sarah wasn't the one cutting throats. To condemn her would be unfair. He hated that her father would be paying him in blood money, but maybe there was some good in relieving such a man of a tiny bit of his surplus fortune. A very tiny bit. He would also promise himself to do something good with some of the money, to buy food for stray dogs. Yes, that was what he would do. And otherwise, he would try to put the slaughterhouses out of his mind. That he found himself enjoying his time at Hereford House was both a relief and reason for self-recrimination. First and foremost, there was Sarah, who appeared unexpectedly and irregularly. Climbing up to the attic, he had chosen to begin in the attic, to help sift through dusty files, matching scribbled receipts to miscellaneous drawings and paintings. The infatuation he'd felt after their first walks had been deflated a bit by the mounting evidence that she saw nothing wrong with her father's business, but his attraction was undiminished. Not that she was flirtatious. She was sharp and attentive and meticulous. She seemed to relish setting things in order. He didn't dare try to kiss her. Alice had been waiting for him that first Monday morning, determined he would not do anything before he'd drawn her portrait. "We'll go outside for the light," she'd announced. He drew her sitting under a cherry tree behind the house, her arms wrapped around one knee, seeming to suppress a smile. As he was working, another tall female figure came striding across the lawn in a skirt and cardigan, Jasper lumbering in her wake. "The portraitist at work," Mrs. Fahey said in a voice even lower and richer than Sarah's. Jamie scrambled to his feet. She offered her hand. Sargent's portrait was apt, though she'd aged. Her hair was cut in a blunt bob, and her face was bare of makeup and full of amused intelligence. "Let's see it," she said, holding a hand out for the drawing pad, which he had lifted out of protective instinct toward his chest. "Oh," she said when he handed it over. "But it's wonderful. I shouldn't be surprised. What you did of Sarah was marvelous, but this is... it's a whole scene. I'm going to have both of them framed."
"Don't you think he should do one of Jasper, Mother?" said Alice.
"Certainly, and one of Penelope and the baby." She gave the drawing pad back to Jamie. "Penelope is my eldest daughter. She has a new baby. I'd want you to draw my son and my other daughter, too, so I could have a complete set, but they're away."
"And you," said Alice, still under the tree.
"What about me?"
"He should draw you, too. See how it stacks up against the sergeant."
Jamie said, "I think the comparison would be depressing." Mrs. Fahey raised an eyebrow.
"For you or me?"
"Me," he said. "Of course. I mean, I would be happy to try, if you want."
"Good, then," she said, amused. "So you shall."
July turned to August. He made progress cataloging the art, but the job was too big for half a summer. Still, he persisted, sorting and describing as best he could. examining so many drawings and paintings was an education. He looked carefully at each piece, considered what the artist had achieved versus what might have been intended. Much of the work seemed mediocre at best. "My husband's greatest pleasure is in the hoarding of his treasures," Mrs. Fahey said one day. "He takes pleasure in their number and in their being his." But the collection also included many fine pieces and more than a few extraordinary ones. As instructed, Jamie set aside any that struck a chord in him, including a set of a dozen unidentified small watercolors he found in a shallow box tied closed with ribbon. They were washes of color, gyres of gray and blue, or bands of brilliant orange and green. And though they could not be said to be clearly of anything, Jamie was certain their subject was the sea. Something illegible was scribbled on their backs. A signature, maybe. If the expert from UW came, Jamie almost hoped he would say the watercolors were junk, because then he might be bold enough to ask if he could keep them. In the evenings, on his way home, he bought cans of tongue or hash, loaves of day-old bread, whatever was cheap, and fed stray dogs. Sometimes he sketched them, a few quick lines. He hated when they snarled and snapped among themselves, or when they followed him back to the boarding house. If Mr. Fahey was not expected home early, Sarah might go for a walk with Jamie after he'd finished cataloging for the day. He'd finally gotten his nerve up to kiss her. The first time had been unexpectedly simple. She had come with him to feed the strays. At their feet, a dog was devouring a mound of canned meat. And he had leaned forward and put his mouth on Sarah's. They'd both stood perfectly still, lips together until Sarah pulled softly away. The next time, beside the waterfront, was not simple. Her long, pliant body had bowed against his, and in his excitement he grasped her too roughly, startling her. With a little practice, though, they found an equilibrium that, while not quite satisfying, was sustainable enough. He could hold her in his arms if no one was around to see, but not squeeze her too hard or push her against a wall, not feel her breasts. Sometimes, though, she forgot herself and pulled him closer, one of her long thighs sliding between his. This never lasted long. She would snap back to propriety and extricate herself, as disorientated as an awakened dreamer, her cheeks flushed. "Tell me more about your adventures," she would say sometimes. And he told her about how he and Marion and Caleb had hitchhiked to Sealy Lake and then hiked the 50 miles back through the mountains, or how they'd once found a human skeleton in the woods with a hatchet lodged in its moss-speckled skull, or about the rail yard bull smacking his shins. "I don't know if those are really adventures," he said. "They are," she exclaimed. "I'll never get to do anything exciting. I wish I could meet Marion and Caleb," she said, "and Wallace."
"Maybe you will someday."
A melancholy Madonna smile.
"I don't think they'd be very impressed by me."
They would find her alien, daunting, prim. They wouldn't know how to be around her. It didn't matter. This, what was between him and Sarah, was his.
"They don't know anyone like you."
"I don't know anyone like them. I wish I were more like them."
This was the moment to tell her everything he'd left out. Wallace is drinking, Barclay McQueen, the creak of the porch's screen door in the night when Caleb came for Marion. But instead, he kissed her again. When he could, he made drawings of her, sometimes from life, sometimes from memory. Some he gave to her, some he kept.
"I love these because I love thinking about you looking at me," she said. "It's a very particular kind of vanity."
Occasionally, when Sarah and Alice were both out, Mrs. Fahey invited him for afternoon coffee in a small glassed-in conservatory that was her particular domain. To get to it, he passed through a parlor that also seemed to be her own. There was no art in these rooms. The walls of her parlor were clean and white, sparsely hung with photographs of her family. Her conservatory held potted ferns, a dog cushion, and a round marble table with wicker chairs where they sat. She asked him many of the same questions Sarah had about his life. But since he was not consumed with romantic anxiety and carnal longings, he could relax more into his account of himself, find opinions he hadn't quite known he possessed. "I wish my sister were more ladylike," he surprised himself by saying one day. Mrs. Fahey smiled with a deeper melancholy than Sarah's. "Why? Does she want that too?" "No, she doesn't," he said frankly. "But her life seems so much more difficult than it needs to be. If she had a girl's haircut and wore girl's clothes, and if she'd kept going to school and didn't care so much about airplanes, everything would be simpler." At Trout's funeral, when Barclay McQueen had turned around to shake Jamie's hand, there had been something sneering and triumphant in his face, as though Jamie were a bested rival. "Peace be with you." "Yes," Mrs. Fahey agreed. "It probably would be. If she'd had a mother, would she have turned out this way, do you think?" "Maybe, maybe not. Mothers don't control everything, though sometimes we'd like to. I've learned, too slowly, but I have learned, that attempts to control others are likely to backfire. I worked for the passage of Prohibition because I earnestly believed women's lives would be better, easier, as you say, if their husbands couldn't go out and drink their paychecks away and come home and do the vile things drunk men sometimes do. But I was naive. People's wishes for their own lives tend to outweigh others' ideas about how they should behave." She paused. "We must bend in the wind sometimes, Jamie. So much is beyond our control." Jamie quashed a tremor of impatience that he couldn't explain things better. Not to this woman sitting in her glass room, serene in her belief that his doting uncle had sent him to Seattle for a summer with his cousins. Marion doesn't always see the problems she's creating for herself. "Is it that you think if she were more ladylike, you wouldn't have to worry about her?"
"I don't know." She leaned forward.
"Would you draw her for me, your sister? I'd like to see what she looks like." So he summoned Marion from a blank page. He forced himself to draw her as she was, with her cropped hair and her sharp, almost insolent gaze. As he drew, he felt a deep tug in his guts, like he'd swallowed a hook and the reel was back in Montana. Mrs. Fahey looked at the drawing for a long time. "Yes, I see. She's formidable." She sighed and patted his forearm. "You've had to take care of each other more than most children and grow up quickly. It must have been very hard sometimes." When he was safely in the attic, he sat on the floor and wept. He had not known how badly he had wanted someone to say exactly that. During a spell of unusual heat in the third week of August, the art expert from UW came, a sprightly man in a bow tie who proceeded rapidly along Hereford House's walls, stooping one moment and stretching on tiptoe the next, peering through his spectacles as though his whole body were a kind of specially designed art-evaluating scope. From time to time, he jotted in a notebook. Jamie followed along, offering what insight he could, all of which the expert greeted either with irritable mm-hmms or silence. Twice, Jamie mentioned he had set aside some works that seemed noteworthy. "I doubt that was necessary," the man said, pulling a small nautical painting from the wall and turning it over. "Mr. Fahey asked me to, so we could get your opinion." "Oh, yes." He hung the painting back on its nail,
What are your qualifications exactly?
I've been cataloging the work.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Fahey came home in mid-afternoon when the two of them were surveying the music room. He pumped the expert's hand, boomed pleasantries at him, demanded to know what he thought.
Your honest opinion, he said.
It's a very, very interesting collection, the expert said. You have many first-rate pieces, as you know. The Sergeant, for example. Truly remarkable.
He took a handkerchief from his pocket and mopped his brow. The house's gloom made the heat especially stifling.
My wife is the subject, Mr. Fahey said with pride.
Is it really? Said the expert, even though Jamie had already told him.
Remarkable.
There's been talk of a museum, Mr. Fahey said. The Fahey Museum.
I like the sound of that, I have to say.
The expert swabbed his face again.
It's an intriguing idea. Perhaps, just as a preliminary impression, this collection might not be quite enough on its own, judging only what I've seen thus far, but certainly you've laid an excellent foundation.
Delicately.
You do know they've begun building an art museum in Volunteer Park to house the Fuller collection.
Mr. Fahey's face clouded.
Of course I know, he said. I can practically see it from my bedroom.
The expert winced, but pressed ahead.
Have you considered perhaps joining forces?
Mr. Fahey eyed him suspiciously.
I have.
The expert became conciliatory. A first step, I think, would be to have someone come in and start sorting through everything, cataloging it. I assume you have records of purchases, attributions, provenances.
That's what Jamie's been doing.
Mr. Fahey fixed Jamie with a perplexed stare.
Didn't you tell him?
I'm sure this young man's been doing his best, the expert said. But it's a job for someone with real expertise.
Mr. Fahey appeared embarrassed. The boy's a gifted artist, he said. I wanted to give him a helping hand. No harm in him rummaging through the lot.
I sincerely hope not, the expert said primly. Jamie's face flamed. The man hadn't even looked at his notes, his meticulous lists, his assembled clues and theories about what exactly Mr. Fahey had bought for himself. Certainly Jamie hadn't uncovered all the answers, that would be impossible, but he was confident he'd been useful. Nor had the expert deigned to look at the pieces he'd brought down from the attic and set aside. He knew those were worth at least a glance.
Jamie, said Mr. Fahey. Go get one of your portraits to show him.
Now his humiliation would be compounded by being treated like a child, made to present his own work as though begging to be indulged with praise. Stiffly, he said,
I wouldn't want to impose. Go on now,
Mr. Fahey said, as though sending away a dog hovering too close to the dinner table. Jamie trudged through the hot, dark house to Mr. Fahey's parlor. The four portraits, Sarah's, Alice's, her own, and that of Penelope, the eldest sister, who had come over one afternoon to sit for him with her baby, were hanging, framed in a row. He yanked down Alice's and trudged back, offered it with his head down. The expert scrutinized the drawing, then peered at Jamie through his spectacles as though he were another artwork to be evaluated.
Who taught you to draw?
His uncle, said Mr. Fahey at the same time Jamie said firmly, no one.
You said your uncle did,
Mr. Fahey told Jamie.
To the expert, he added, his uncle is the painter Wallace Graves. I own a landscape of his, actually.
I taught myself, Jamie said, digging his hands into his pockets.
Mm-hmm,
said the expert. He looked over the portrait again, then back at Jamie.
You said you'd selected some works you especially liked?
There would be a celebratory dinner, and Jamie must stay.
Mr. Fahey insisted. Everyone insisted. The watercolor sketches he'd found in the ribbon-tied box, the washes of color that suggested the moods of the ocean, were by J.M.W. Turner. The expert was almost certain. They were valuable, important, remarkable, and might so easily have gone overlooked. For his part, Jamie was both vindicated and disappointed, as he had decided that if the expert would not look at the works he'd picked out, he was going to take the watercolors back to the boarding house that very night, and then, soon enough, to Missoula. He still wished, just a little, that he had taken them when he first found them, told no one.
"Well done,"
Mr. Fahey had said to Jamie at least half a dozen times.
"I knew I saw something in you."
Even with the windows open, the dining room was sweltering. Sweat dampened the women's temples. Mr. Fahey kept mopping his brow with his napkin. The second eldest Fahey sister, Nora, the art history student, had just returned from Europe, and Penelope had come over with her husband, an infant, and nanny. There was talk that Jamie must draw Nora after dinner to complete the pantheon in Mrs. Fahey's parlor.
"Don't forget Daddy," Alice said.
"I wouldn't dream of inflicting this mug on Jamie after such a parade of beauties," Mr. Fahey said. He was in high spirits, pinker and shinier than ever.
The first course was oysters, then cold consommé, then poached salmon. Nora was full of observations about Europe.
"On the crossing, there was always a breeze. One gets used to the cooling effect."
"Does one?"
Alice asked, putting on a queenly accent and looking down her nose. Jamie had eaten the oysters, and despite misgivings, the salmon, had vainly hoped by some miracle the meal would not involve beef. When the inevitable steak was placed in front of him, a thin crimson liquid pooling around it, he looked surreptitiously for Jasper, but the dog must have been shut away somewhere. "I'm interested in this young man's plan for the future," said the art expert, turning to him. Everyone looked at Jamie.
"I have another year of high school," he said, "and then I'll probably go to the University of Montana."
"To study art," said the expert.
"I'm not sure," Jamie said.
Mr. Fahey leaned back in his chair, chewing.
"How is the art department at Montana?"
"I think it's good enough," Jamie said. "My uncle taught," he caught himself, "teaches in it."
Mr. Fahey pushed more steak into his mouth, took a gulp of wine, and said,
"I think you ought to come to Seattle, either to UW or Cornish College. Talent like yours, you shouldn't be stuck in a backwater."
Jamie almost laughed at the idea that he could afford such a thing.
"Furthermore," said Mr. Fahey,
"some would say Seattle is the definition of a backwater," Nora observed, "compared to Europe."
"Nora," said Alice, "don't be stupid."
Sarah said, "It's snobbery, not stupidity."
"Furthermore," said Mr. Fahey again, raising his voice, "I would like to help you."
The Fahey women looked at one another.
"I don't think I understand," Jamie said.
"I'm saying I'll pay for your schooling and expenses, boy. You'd continue working for me, of course, in one way or another. Maybe with the art, depending on how things shape up with this museum idea, or maybe with my business."
He pointed his knife at Jamie.
"I'm a self-made man myself."
This in a tone of light interest, as though he had not already said so many times already.
"I like to give others a leg up when I can."
Jamie, flabbergasted, didn't know what to say. He longed to accept, to fall back into the Fahey's as though into a feather bed. If he did, incredible as it seemed, his vision of himself as a husband to Sarah, the father of her children, a prosperous citizen of a Pacific city, might plausibly come to pass. But ambivalence stopped him.
There were the slaughterhouses, and yes, he liked to draw, and over the summer he'd grown vain about his talent. But what if there was a latent Wallace in him? What if, by becoming an artist, he would create the right conditions for dissolution and anarchy to spread through him like a fungus? He needed to think more, and not in this hot room, at this table full of fahis and their plates of bleeding beef.
"You've left him speechless, Daddy," said Penelope.
Mr. Fahy said, "Finish up your steak and we'll have some champagne to celebrate." Then he looked more closely at Jamie's plate. "Why, you've barely eaten anything. Are you ill, boy?"
Jamie glanced at Sarah, who looked back with perplexity. "Aren't you hungry?" she said. It didn't matter, he realized, whether or not he wanted to be an artist. He said,
"I don't eat meat."
"What?"
Mr. Fahy appeared genuinely confounded. "I don't eat meat."
"No meat?"
"No."
"Is it some kind of religious belief?"
"No, sir. I just can't abide the idea of it."
"I don't follow."
"You feel sorry for the poor animals," Nora exclaimed. "That's it, isn't it?"
Mr. Fahy sat back. His face was turning burgundy.
"You can't abide the idea of my business, the business that built this house, that bought this art, that's paid you all summer?"
"I couldn't accept your offer," Jamie said, "though I appreciate your generosity."
"You couldn't."
Mr. Fahy cut himself off with a small sputter.
"The offer is rescinded. I couldn't trust a man who doesn't eat like one."
He narrowed his eyes. "And you're not to hang around my daughter anymore. Don't think I don't see you trailing after her." Desperately, Jamie searched Sarah's face for understanding, but he saw only confusion and worry. She looked at her mother, who gazed steadily back, gave the smallest of nods. Sarah gathered herself, said to her father,
"He doesn't trail after me."
"You're not to see him anymore."
Again, she looked to her mother, but this time Mrs. Fahy was studying her plate.
Tears overflowed onto Sarah's cheeks, but Jamie saw she would not go against her father.
"Son,"
Mr. Fahy was pointing a thick finger at him.
"Son, God put animals on this earth for food. Animals kill and eat each other. We're animals too. We're just smart enough to have figured out a better way to get meat than wandering around with bows and arrows. We've bred these animals to eat them. Cattle and pigs and chickens wouldn't exist if they weren't food."
He opened his mouth, pointed to his canines.
"These," he said, "God gave us these to show us what he wants us to eat. And that is the steak on your plate."
Jamie put his napkin on the table, rose from his chair. "Goodbye," he said. "Thank you."
As he walked down the hall, he could hear Mr. Fahy shouting after him that he was an apostate and a fairy, and that he should get out of his house.
He did not feed the dogs that night. He went to Union Station and bought a ticket on a night train to Spokane and then on to Missoula. Lonely and righteous, Jamie went home and learned his sister was engaged to Barclay McQueen.
Missoula, August 1931, 2 weeks before Jamie came home. A pale evening sky, deep rivers of shadow between the mountains. Marion circled until the drivers switched on their headlights, landed on the strip of flat land they'd illuminated. While they were unloading the cases, Caleb came walking out of the forest, his rifle across his back. The driver's hands went to their holsters.
"It's all right," Marion cried. "He's my friend."
She jogged to meet Caleb, threw her arms around him in a way she would not have if they'd met in Missoula. Out here, there was a sense of occasion.
"How did you find me?"
He was brown from the sun. His hair was braided down his back.
A little bird told me. How about a lift home?
Caleb had built himself a small cabin up the rattlesnake from Wallace's house. She glanced at the men, who were making no secret of watching them.
You won't be scared?
What's there to be scared of? Aren't you a good pilot?
She'd been late arriving, and now they were late taking off. Darkness had fallen entirely by the time they reached Missoula, and the city's lights shone gold among the mountains. After she'd put the plane to bed, Marion drove Caleb back through town, up the creek past Gilda's house, past Wallace's house. After the road had dwindled to a rutted track in the forest, he told her to stop where a trail led off through the trees.
Come have a drink, he said. You saved me 2 days walking.
The cabin was not far. As they walked in the dark, Marion said, Why don't you get a car?
I don't want the responsibility. I don't really like ownership in general.
Sometimes it's worth it on balance, isn't it? She said. Not that I have much experience.
I'd rather keep things simple.
His cabin stood in a circular clearing and was small but expertly constructed, with tightly notched corners and each log hewn to sit flat on the next, smooth strips of mud daubing sealing the gaps. He took a key from his pocket.
You lock your door, she observed.
So?
So you want to keep owning some things, at least.
Sure, but I resent the worry of it.
He ushered her in, and she stood in darkness as he lit a kerosene lamp, and then another, revealing a squatting black stove, a rocking chair, a cot, a bearskin on the floor, antlers on the walls.
Take off your boots, would you?
The cabin's interior was perfectly, painstakingly tidy. The blanket on the cot was tucked smoothly around the thin mattress. Another was folded across the foot. His few dishes were stacked on a shelf above the sink. He hung his rifle on a rack that held three others, their stocks and barrels gleaming.
Did you cut the logs yourself? She said.
He was pouring whiskey into tin mugs.
I did, but I bought milled lumber for the roof and rafters.
Handing her a mug and indicating the rocking chair, he said, Sit there. He busied himself lighting a fire in the stove. When he sat on the cot, their knees were almost touching.
You keep your place very tidy.
I had enough mess for a lifetime with Gilda.
You were so savage when you were little, and now look at you, sweeping and folding, everything in its proper place.
Everything savage stays outside now, in its proper place.
Do you have a girl, Caleb?
Can't I keep my cabin clean without you seeing a woman's touch?
It's not that. I've just wondered ever since we stopped.
She didn't need to finish the sentence. They'd never put a word to it anyway. It had always been a kind of ellipsis. He leaned back against the wall, his legs crossed.
There are girls, he said, but there's no girl.
He watched her. She saw a languid stirring of his old slyness. She thought he would make a joke or a proposition, but he said,
I've been on Barclay McQueen's ranch before.
Bannockburn. Caleb nodded.
Some associates of his hired me for a hunt. We had permission. Nice country. The house is something.
Good or bad? He shrugged.
Depends on your taste in houses.
I've only seen it from the air, even though I might.
She stopped. He finished for her. Go to live there.
She nodded. Her chest was tight. Why was she afraid? Caleb got up to pour more whiskey into her mug. He stood beside her, his hand on her nape. His touch was cool. She'd forgotten the coolness of him.
Who cuts your hair now?
Someone who charges in money.
He tugged her out of the chair and onto the floor with him. Sideways into the triangular space between his legs, loose in his arms. For a long time, he held her in silence. He kissed her mouth, but the kiss was innocent, led no further. Everything that had ever happened with Caleb seemed innocent now, compared with Barclay.
"Your heartbeat is coming through your whole body," he said.
"I'm telling it to stop."
"Not stop.
To slow down. It's not listening."
"I could help you go away. There are places where he wouldn't find you."
She resented Barclay horribly. Her gratitude to Barclay was bottomless. She wished she could vanish and never return. She couldn't bear leaving him.
"Who are you?"
"The funny thing is, I think I love Barclay. I've never admitted that before." His cheek was against the top of her head.
"You have a strange way of showing it."
She knew she should leave. She wished they could crawl into his cot together. "It's a strange kind of..." She trailed off.
She could not say the word love again.
"It's a strange thing." Barclay knew she had flown a man from the mountain strip back to Missoula. And he knew that man was Caleb. And he knew she'd driven him to his cabin and stayed inside for 3 hours.
3 hours, he said.
They were standing in the kitchen of the green and white house, the table between them.
"Tell me, what could possibly have kept you busy for 3 hours?
"If you sent a spy after me," she said, furious, "he probably looked through the window. So what did I do?"
"You screwed him."
His certainty drew her up short. "But I didn't."
"Don't lie."
Black eyes, stark freckles. "I'm not. You're lying. I know because I'm telling the truth." A silent standoff, both incredulous. "He's my friend," Marion said. "He's always been my friend. Am I not allowed to have friends?" Her voice rose. "Do you want me to be completely alone except for you?" He sat down heavily, the anger going out of him.
"Yes," he said, "if I'm being honest."
"You want to know what we did? We talked." She gathered herself, said as though making an accusation. "I told Caleb I loved you."
He looked up. "You did?
When did you start having me followed?"
"Say it again. Tell me what you told him."
He was radiating thrilled pleasure. She felt only hopelessness. "Not now."
"Tell me you love me."
Louder, she said. "When did you start having me followed?"
"After you flew to Vancouver. Only because I was so afraid of losing you."
Thank God Caleb had stopped their trysts when he had.
"I thought you would do something foolish and get yourself into another bad situation," Barclay said. "It was for your protection. I wasn't looking to trap you, only to keep you safe."
"We don't trust each other. We should admit it."
"I'll stop if we're married."
Vehemently, because when we're married, I'll take your vows as your promise not to run away. Because I know you're honorable. He stood again, came around the table, and knelt at her feet.
"Say it now. Please. Tell me what you told him. It should be between us, not you and him."
She did as he asked. As the words left her, they caused a strange sensation, as though a knife had been in her gut, and pulling it out was both a relief and a new wound, a fatal breach. She had known she would have to admit eventually that she loved him. And now she had, and now she could let it be true. He pressed his face into her thighs. She touched his head. He looked up and said,
"I love you so much, Marion. But I have to tell you something. And before I tell you, you have to know that I'm sorry. I wouldn't have done it if I'd known. I should have waited."
She was frozen. She was in the cockpit over the crevasse.
"There's something. I set something in motion when I was angry. But I can undo it."
His eyes were full of tears.
"Marion,
I've done a terrible thing. But you have to understand, you made me wait too long.
The cosmic whoosh of the expanding universe. 11. I'd once heard a costume designer say the best actresses didn't even look in the mirror. They felt a costume. At fittings for Marion, I kept my face turned away from my reflection as though it would turn me to stone. I walked around in a heavy coverall flight suit thing and sheepskin boots, feeling as burdened and out of my element as an astronaut marooned on Earth. On one wall, a patchwork of photos of female pilots and random era-appropriate people had been pinned up along with costume sketches and pretty much every photo of Marion in existence, and I wallowed slowly over to look. I'd seen her wedding photo before, online, where she and the gangster Barclay McQueen are standing outside a handsome courthouse, leaves blowing around their feet. Marion is holding her hat on her head and smiling wanly, as though at an unfunny joke. Her new husband looks elated. Next to it was a printout of a portrait in charcoal I hadn't seen before. Marion was very young in it, almost but not quite a child. Her haircut very short, a look on her face like she was about to contradict whatever you just said. "What's this?" I asked. The costume designer had followed me across the room and was fussing with a strap at my waist. "Her brother drew it. It's in a private collection somewhere. Isn't it lovely? So much personality." She was tugging me backward, turning me to face her assistants. They studied me. "She looks like a flying squirrel," one said. He held up an arm and gestured to the space under it. "All webbed in here." "It's authentic," the designer said defensively. "A real-deal Sidcot suit. But I think we can tailor it so her shape isn't quite so lost." My resolve cracked. I glanced in the mirror. They'd already cut my hair down to a severe sort of pixie and bleached it. I was a small, pale head atop a huge brown body, puffy and fungus-like. "Don't worry," the designer said. "We'll make it more flattering." "I don't care about that," I lied. "I promise," she said, as though she hadn't heard. "You'll look great." Siobhan called to say Redwood Pfeiffer wanted to have me over to his house for lunch. Always with the fucking lunches. "Just me and him?" I considered informing her that I would not be giving this guy a blowjob. My career was no longer a blowjob-based barter economy. "It's a little unusual, but I don't think he knows that. I think he's so rich he's used to hanging out with anyone he wants. You should think of it as a friendly thing. He seems like an okay guy." "He's the money," her tone said. Redwood's house was only 2 miles west of mine as the crow flies, though crow flight is a less than useless measurement in the hills, where the streets are as kinked and looped as silly string. I left MG behind and drove myself, thinking it might be offensive to bring a bodyguard to lunch. I was 20 minutes late by the time I pressed the buzzer on Redwood's security box and followed the driveway's Nautilus curve to a hunkered-down house that was all sharp edges and raw concrete, like the bunker of an impossibly chic warlord. Redwood was waiting on his brutalist doorstep in Adidas sneakers and a rumpled tan linen suit over a t-shirt with the jacket sleeves rolled up. "Buenos dias," he said as I walked toward him. "Wow, I like your haircut. Trey Marion." Confidently, he opened his arms for a hug. "What's the good word?" Just a moment too late, he saw my hesitation, my slight affront at his presumption, and switched smoothly to handshake mode. "I never know how to answer that," I said, shaking hands. Do you say fine? Like the good word is fine? Now that you mention it, I don't actually know. Maybe you just say a word you like. He was leading me into a gigantic room that was fully open to the outdoors on one side. I'd seen houses like this before. Their suspicious slit-eye pillboxes on one side, and on the other, nothing but openness and innocence. Letting in the whole city-encrusted valley, the whole sky. Enormous sliding glass doors were recessed back into the walls so Redwood didn't have to deal with anything as gauche and disruptive as windows. Tart, I said. That can be my good word. Augustina had used it that morning to describe a certain PR person's tone, and I'd felt a little trill of pleasure. But which meaning? All of them? That's why it's a good word. The meanings speak to each other. Ah, yes, I get it. The tempting dessert, the seductive woman, the sharp, sour taste. Very nice. What's yours? He considered. I'll go with perchance. Why? It's funny, and it expresses ambivalence, which is my go-to emotion. Either that or mayhaps. We walked through a room with low couches and a huge flat screen, past a gleaming black grand piano, and out onto the patio. There were four chaises lined up next to a pool, and beyond, the big flat circuit board of Los Angeles planing off into pale haze. Cool house, I said. Thanks. It's a rental while I decide if I want to move here. None of this stuff is mine. He gazed off at the indistinct horizon. I know this is a really obvious observation, but I feel the need to make it anyway. The sprawl of this place is legit mind-blowing, especially when you fly in. Do you look out the window on planes? Sometimes. You can see the most amazing things. Like, once I was on a flight to Europe, and the pilot came on and said the northern lights were going off out the left side. And basically no one bothered to lift up their shade. There's something damning about that. How people didn't look.
I've never seen them.
But wouldn't you look? They're wild. Sheets of green, like you'd expect. But it's the scale that blew my mind. How they're moving crazy fast, but somehow you can't even really see them moving. I read a poem once that described the aurora as the moon hanging up her silken laundry, and another that called it glowworm light. I like that. His earnestness had me off balance. Who talks about poems? I said, I went in a glowworm cave once.
What's a glowworm cave?
What it sounds like. A cave with glowworms living on the ceiling. It's pitch dark, and the worms really look like stars, even though they're just larvae. The one I went in had water. Maybe there has to be water, I'm not sure. And the worms were reflected, so you felt surrounded by all these little points of white light. What even is this? Alexei had said while we floated through the cave. Could we be dead? Would we even know?
I don't think we'd know anything, I'd said. In general.
Yeah, he'd said. It's just wishful thinking that life and death would be interchangeable. This is nice, though. It's very nice.
The whole thing had been impossible from the beginning, of course. But I still felt a stupid sense of loss whenever I thought about him. Other people get to have infatuations that last long enough to become real love, and then disappointment and boredom. I only got the cold, extraterrestrial luminescence of an afternoon and evening spent staring into someone's face and saying, "Yes, exactly. I know exactly what you mean."
I'd like to see that someday, Redwood said about the glowworms. Here, come in the kitchen. I have a couple more things to do, and then we can eat.
You cooked?
It's a salad. I assembled.
The kitchen's big sliding doors were open to the patio, and he'd set two places at a table under a pergola grown over with wisteria. While he whisked vinaigrette, he said,
"Sorry, I'm realizing now that I didn't really think through how much like a date this would feel. I hope it's not awkward for you. I just wanted a chance to talk without any minders around."
"Will it feel more or less like a date if we have a glass of wine?" I said.
"Who cares?"
He opened the refrigerator, its stainless steel door as large and heavy as a bank vault's, and retrieved a bottle, poured two glasses. His hands were unexpectedly elegant, his fingers long and deft. We clinked.
"Cheers. You read Marion's book, right? Don't break my heart and tell me you only read the script."
"Of course I read it," I said, as though I would ever think of not reading the book. As though I'd read all the Archangel books and not, as was the truth, only the first one. I'd actually read it before, as a kid, basically by accident. I realized I was wading into a conversation about my parents, so I said, "I read your mom's book, too."
"What'd you think?"
Before I could answer with some vague flattery, he said,
"I know, it's not the best thing ever written. I thought I should say that. I didn't want you to think I thought it was some masterpiece."
"It's good," I said.
So noncommittal. "But what?"
I looked at him over the rim of my glass. But nothing.
"Come on, say it. I'm not defensive about her book. She is, fair warning, but I'm not."
I suspected he was setting a trap, but I still answered. I said I thought the voice of the book, Marion's voice, the I his mother had given her, didn't line up with the voice in the actual book Marion had written, as herself, for real. "All I knew," Carol Pfeiffer had written, as Marion, "all I'd ever known was that I belonged to the sky." "All I knew," she'd written in the next chapter, "all I'd ever known was that no man would ever own me." In her journal, in what's now Namibia, Marion had written, "I like to think I will remember this particular moon, seen from the particular angle of this balcony on this night. But if I forget, I will never know that I've forgotten, as is the nature of forgetting. I've forgotten so much, almost all I've seen. Experience washes over us in great waves. Memory is a drop caught in a flask, concentrated and briny, nothing like the fresh abundance from which it came." I told Redwood I thought Carol had missed the point of Marion a little bit. I said the book felt wishful, like it was trying to force Marion to be something, someone, more familiar and reassuring than she actually was. Redwood nodded almost sorrowfully and said, "Yes, he knew what I meant.
It's trying to bend Marion to make her more, I hate this word, relatable. But in the end, it distorts her."
"Exactly," I said. More than once, while reading Carol's book, I'd thought of the fan fiction Oliver and I had read about ourselves, the dollhouse feeling of it. The author gripping us so tightly we might have snapped in half. "I live you so much." Redwood blew out a long breath.
"My mother has strong impulses toward tidiness. She's not religious, but she still thinks everything happens for a reason. In the middle of a nuclear war, she'd be the one saying everything was going to be fine. And it's nice she's an optimist, but annoying she's not more of a realist. I'm not sure she actually remembers anymore what parts of the book she invented. Anyway, I made a decision to be purely supportive. Grab the wine, would you?"
He picked up the salad. I followed him outside. "It sounds like you guys are close,"
She's my non-evil parent. She and my dad got divorced when I was 6, and we were always kind of a team. He's dead now. I'm sorry. We sat. He put out cloth napkins, a bowl of flaky salt with a little spoon in it, a carafe of ice water. It's okay. I hated him, insofar as anyone actually manages to hate a parent. I'm still sorry. Thanks. I hate him less now that I don't have to interact with him. That sounds complicated. I don't know. Sometimes things are simple. Redwood told me that his father had been chief counsel for a chemical company that was an offshoot of Liberty Oil, and had spent his days fighting lawsuits brought by tumor-ridden plant workers, towns with contaminated groundwater, chemists whose discoveries had been stolen, environmental groups concerned about air and water and frogs and birds. Then, in one of those instances of random, abrupt mortality that create the illusion of cosmic justice, he'd dropped dead of a brain aneurysm at 64. My parents died when I was 2, I said. Small plane crash. I know. Google. Right. I'm sorry, too. It's okay. I didn't know them. That's what I'm sorry for. We're getting right into the dead parents convo. Wow. He smiled, chewing, a little squinty. And there was something about the way he was looking at me, something skeptical and amused, that made me think he might not be as much of a dupe as we all thought. He said, "By dessert, we'll have worked around to small talk. Hey, was it hard cutting off all your hair?" I'd stared into the mirror at the salon like an arsonist watching a house burn down. I ran a hand over my head. It was a relief. I feel lighter. Maybe I should cut mine. I tilted my head and studied him. "Not yet," I said. He smiled. I said, "So if you're perchance sort of ambivalent about your mom's book, why didn't you just commission the Day Brothers to adapt Marion's?" He made a face. "I mean, all things being equal, I would have, but I didn't want to hurt my mom's feelings." Marion was a shared obsession of theirs, he said. Carol had read Marion's book aloud to him when he was a child. His father had given her the book when they were dating, and Redwood thought she might have married him partly because of it, because she fell in love with the idea of Matilda Pfeiffer and the family connection, the family legend. "I think she wanted to be part of the story," he said. "Like of the Josephina Eterna and Marion and all the titans of industry stuff. But that story's over, so she just ended up in a really different, really not great one." He said the Day Brothers had surprised him by being unexpectedly fired up about his mother's book. All the overwrought conjecture gave them something to work with, tonally. Redwood said he'd imagined a more conceptual film, something about the ambiguity of disappearance, maybe like a spiritual, metaphysical Terrence Malick take. Of course he had. But what the Days had written would be cool and high concept in a different way, like a tiny bit camp. "Right," I said, 100%. And I needed to believe him, even though what he was describing wasn't quite what I'd imagined. We worked on our salads. He said, "How does the process work? Figuring out how to play a part?" I wanted to say that I just put the plastic pony in the plastic stable and smiled the way they told me to. But I said, "I imagine myself as someone else. That's pretty much it." I asked Sir Hugo the same question, and he talked for an hour. Fucking Hugo. So sure people would want to listen to him talk. Of course, people did want to listen to him talk. To that voice, all smoke and whiskey and the north wind. Just try to find a nature documentary Hugo hasn't narrated. Just try to find an animated villain he hasn't voiced. I'll sound ridiculous if I try to explain it, I said. Like me with the Northern Lights. Like me with the stupid glowworms. He pinged his glass lightly against mine. To mystery. May we not ruin it. 12. After lunch, Redwood and I moved to the chaises by his pool, kept going with the wine, gossiped about people in Hollywood, trotted out our best anecdotes, ventured small confidences. The pool tiles were tiny and square and cobalt blue, and the water was perfectly smooth, dense-looking like gelatin. I didn't feel the way with Redwood I'd felt with Alexei, but I felt something, some zing or zip. Was the lack of warm light reason enough not to embark on something? What if I never had the warm light ever again? I didn't think the answer was becoming a nun, married to the memory of a brief affair with a married dude. Was it stupid to sleep with the money? Was it stupid not to? Maybe I wanted him to kiss me just so I could confirm he wanted to. Maybe I wanted him to fall in love with me so I could decide whether or not I wanted to be in love with him. You get used to people falling in love with the idea of being with you. You think you should always have their feelings in hand, like a down payment. How are things with Oliver? He asked from behind his sunglasses. I haven't heard from him. Nothing. Nada. And how do you feel about that? I guess I'm surprised he could walk away without needing to yell at me. Most people want you to witness how much you've hurt them, but not him, apparently. I don't know if that means I didn't really hurt him or that he has more dignity than I thought. I made my face a study in neutrality. And you? Anyone special? No one at all. When I'd Googled Redwood, I'd clicked through watermarked society shots of him with an array of beautiful, serious-seeming women. I'm not sure I believe you. It's the truth. A pause. I said, I have a question. Shoot. Why do you have a grand piano? It came with the house, but I do play. The piano is part of the reason I picked this place. Will you play for me? Yes. Most people at least pretend to be reluctant. I like to show off, but stay out here. I don't know what he played. It was slow and sad. The notes drifted out the open mouth of his bunker house, settled on my skin. I looked over the valley through the sound as though through mist. Then he stopped, and I was myself again. Could have been worse, I told him, but he heard what I was really saying. It's my party trick. I thought of Jones Cohen removing my earring with his tongue, diamonds hanging from his lips. In the evening, pink light submerged the city. I said I wanted to swim, thinking of skinny dipping, but Redwood went into the house and came back with a one-piece bathing suit for me that smelled faintly of chlorine. I didn't ask whose it was. The cool water felt sharp and shivery on my sunburned skin. I leaned back against the infinity edge, and Redwood waded toward me, rosy light reflected in the droplets on his beard. I thought he was going to kiss me, but he just leaned against the edge too, facing the other way, looking out. After dark, when the city was lit up orange as a flat field of poppies, and we were back on the chaises wrapped in towels, he asked if I felt like eating some shrooms. I said sure. He went inside and came out with a foil-wrapped bar of chocolate.
Sir Hugo's boyfriend gave this to me. I have no idea how strong it is. If it's from Rudy, probably really strong. We each ate a square. Redwood got to his feet. I'm going to turn off those lights. He went inside. The lights in the pool went off, and then the indoor lights. Piano music emanated from the house again, something dissonant and tattered sounding, full of holes and gaps. I didn't know if it was supposed to sound that way, or if this was now a song in the key of Shroom. The mauve light of the city pulsed in the sky and on the pool's surface. The music started to draw together, to become something that made sense, and I felt like I could pull it toward me, shape it into a mass I would hurl out over the valley like a storm. Marion had written, "The world unfurls and unfurls, and there is always more. A line, a circle, is insufficient. I look forward, and there is the horizon. I look back, horizon. What's past is lost. I am already lost to my future." Listening to Redwood play, I thought about how the medium of music is time. How if time stopped, a painting would exist unchanged, but music would vanish, like a wave without an ocean. I wanted to tell him this, but when he came back, I got distracted by how his aura was gray and wispy like smoke. "I can see your aura," I said.
"What does it look like?"
"Like smoke." The city sparkled and revolved like a galaxy. "They call it the City of Angels," he said. "But the name actually just means the angels. And like, what angels?"
"All of them," I said, "I guess."
"It's really exciting," he said. "We're making something out of nothing." I thought he was talking about us. I wanted to say, "That's what all relationships are." But then he said, "Well, not nothing. Marion was real, obviously. But people's lives don't get preserved like fossils. The best you can hope for is that time will have hardened around someone's memory, preserving a void in their shape." Or he said something like that. And I realized he was talking about the movie, not us. "You might find out some things," he said, "but it'll never be enough. Never be anything like the whole truth. You're better off just deciding what kind of story you want to tell and telling it." I think that's sort of what he said. I said, "But where do we begin? Where's the beginning?" He forgot to answer. Or maybe I'd only asked inside my head. And for some unmeasurable period of time, we sat there looking at the view, thinking about whatever. And then he was like, "What is this place?" "It's the angels," I told him. "I know," he said. "But what is it?" I could hear wind chimes coming from a neighbor's house. So I was like, "It's wind chimes. What else?" A helicopter went blinking by. "It's helicopters." "What else?" "It's wind chimes and helicopters," I said. "And it's muscle cars and leaf blowers and trash trucks picking up everyone's bins and tossing them back like tequila shots. It's coyotes yipping like delinquents who have just left lit firecrackers in a mailbox. And it's mourning doves sitting on power lines practicing the same sad four-note riff. It's the thrum of hummingbird wings and the silent gliding gyres of vultures and the long-legged stepping of white egrets through shallow green water in the concrete channel that's the river. It's dance music pounding in a dark room full of people pedaling bicycles going nowhere.
its gongs and ohms and whale songs soothing in the dim inner sancta of spas. It's a Norteño song bouncing out of a passing El Camino, and school kids singing, "Oh, beautiful for spacious skies," in a classroom with the windows open and the rasp of a beat from somebody's earbuds you pass on the sidewalk. It's pit bulls barking through chain link, and chihuahuas yapping behind screen doors, and poodles snoozing on terracotta tiles. It's blenders and grinders and juicers and hissing steel espresso machines the size of submarines, and waiters who talk too much. Any special plans for the weekend? Do anything special over the weekend? And water, so precious, splashing into fountains and pools and hot tubs and tall glasses on shaded patios, burbling from hoses and geysering from broken pipes. And underneath, there's the hum of traffic, always there, like the ocean that lives in seashells, like the cosmic whoosh of the expanding universe. At least that's what I tried to tell him. I don't know what I actually said. Then he said something about how LA is dust and exhaust and the hot, dry wind that sets your nerves on edge and pushes fire up the hillside in ragged lines like tears in the paper that separates us from hell, and its towering clouds of smoke, and its sunshine that won't let up, and cool ocean fog that gets unrolled at night over the whole basin like a clean white hospital sheet and peeled back again in the morning. It's a crescent moon in a sky bruised green after the sunset has beaten the shit out of it. It's a lazy hammock moon rising over power lines, over the skeletal silhouettes of pylons, over shaggy cypress trees and the spiky black lionfish shapes of palm tree crowns on two skinny trunks. It's the big one that's coming to turn the city to rubble and set the rubble on fire, but not today. Hopefully not today. It's the obviousness of pointing out that the freeway looks like a ruby bracelet stretched alongside a diamond one. Looks like a river of lava flowing counter to a river of champagne bubbles. People talk about the sprawl, and yeah, the city is a drunk, laughing bitch sprawled across the flats in a spangled dress, legs kicked up the canyons, skirt spread over the hills, and she's shimmering, vibrating, ticklish with light. Don't buy a star map. Don't go driving around gawking, because you're already there, man. You're in it. It's all one big map of the stars. At least that's what I heard him saying. And I was like, you know what? It's mostly just houses. And when you think about houses, really think, aren't they so weird? They're boxes where we keep ourselves and our stuff. Boxes shaped like Tudor manors and chic cement warlord bunkers like this one, and glassy mod spaceships and geodesic domes and sleek vitrines. LA is mysterious, crumbling old hilltop piles. And its haciendas wrapped in bougainvillea and craftsman bungalows neat as a pin and little flat-roofed adobe things with bars on the windows. And its surf shacks and drug shacks and grumpy old man no solicitors shacks and patchouli shacks strung with prayer flags. Windows glowing red through printed Indian cotton as though inside is the beating heart of everything. It's the tents of the homeless crowded under an overpass. It's the spherical mud nests of swallows high up under an overpass. It's vines hanging from an overpass like a beaded curtain. It's trash blowing around in the hot, dry wind nesting in ice plant by the freeway. It's the teasing, skipping, arcing fan dance of lawn sprinklers. It's the snip-snip of pruning shears and the plunk of lemons falling from laden branches to split open and rot on the sidewalk under hovering bees. And it's the placid blue gliding pool net maneuvered by a gardener in a broad straw hat, graceful as a gondolier. It's grass dying of thirst and tall berms of oleander running down the middle of the freeway, blooming and poisonous and hardy as fuck, dividing northbound from southbound, lava from champagne. And it's cacti and yuccas and aloes and agaves and water-hoarding succulents with names like Blue Chalk Fingers and Blue Horizon and Queen of the Night and Burrow's Tail and Purple Emperor and Fire Sticks and Cobweb House Sleek and Zebra Haworthia and Campfire Jade and Ghost Plant and Flamingo Glow and String of Pearls and Painted Lady.